Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Sunstone Podcast, where there is always more than one way to Mormon. I'm Stephen Carter, and I'm here to introduce this episode. Linda King Newell died recently, which means that both authors of Mormon Enigma, Emma Hale Smith, are no longer with us, as Valene Tippetts Avery died in 2006. Now, Mormon Enigma is truly one of the turning points in the telling of Mormon history. And, as with all turning points in the telling of Mormon history, the book has quite an interesting history itself, including an encounter with Mark Hoffman and a church ban on both authors from speaking. Lucky for all of us, Linda told the riveting story of how she and Valene wrote the book, and how it changed their lives at the 2009 Salt Lake Symposium. So, without further ado...
My own journey with Emma Smith began in 1973 when we were living in Ohio. I attended a BYU Education Week where Jane Ann Payne, Utah's Mother of the Year and runner-up to the National Mother of the Year contest, had been one of the speakers. Her topic was my friend Eliza R. Snow. She spoke eloquently of Eliza, often comparing her with Emma Smith, but each reference to Emma became a put-down. Emma was not as faithful as Eliza. Emma abandoned the church and her faith when she did not come west with Brigham Young, as Eliza did. Emma kept the prophet's sons from the church. And Emma did not love Joseph as much as Eliza did. Well, naive as I was, this was the first time I even knew that Eliza R. Snow had been one of Joseph's plural wives. That bit of information didn't happen to be in the Sunday school manuals. Instinctively, I felt the comparisons were unfair and pledged to find a good biography of Emma that would balance Jane Ann's rhetoric. There wasn't one. Only a small 25-page pamphlet called Judge Me, Dear Reader by Irwin Workus and a biographical novel, Emma Smith, the Elect Lady, by RLDS writer Margaret Gibson. The latter was truly a work of fiction. And Workus asked us to forgive Emma's transgressions because she, after all, had suffered a mental breakdown. When Jack took a job at the University of Utah in 1974, I decided that even though I didn't know much about church history, nor had I written anything beyond a college term paper, I could do a better job than either Margaret Gibson or Irwin Workus. I could do the research if I could find someone with writing experience to work with me. My husband, Jack, had become acquainted with Val and Chuck Avery at Duke University in 1962. The two men were both graduate students, Chuck in forestry and Jack in American history. I met them 3 years later, and in the ensuing years, we managed to get together with the Averys a number of times at various places and exchanged Christmas letters. By the fall of 1975, after we had arrived in Utah, Chuck had been diagnosed with MS. We were living in Salt Lake, and the Averys were in Flagstaff, Arizona. And we decided that we would have Thanksgiving together, all of us, in Flagstaff. After our fill of turkey and all the wonderful things that go with it, Val and I sat in front of the fire talking. I began to tell her of my frustration that there was not a biography of Emma Hale Smith. I told her about my desire to write one, but that I needed a co-author. Val said, "Why don't we do it together?" Without hesitation, I said, "You're on." What I didn't know was that Val had never written anything beyond a college term paper either. We each had four children. Val had three boys, ages 13, 12, and 7, and a girl, 10. I had three girls, ages 9, 6, and Heather was 6 months, and a boy, 3. The task would not be easy. With me living in Salt Lake and Val in Flagstaff, we agreed that the primary research would fall to me because of my access to LDS Church archives and those at the University of Utah, BYU, Utah State University, the Utah Historical Society, and eventually, when they finally opened up to general research, the Daughters of the Utah Pioneers. Val would start by reading and making notes on the secondary sources and build a chronology. 6 weeks later, in January of 1976, I made my first visit to the LDS Church History Archives. That day, I met Leonard Arrington, Jim Allen, Davis Benton, Dean Jesse, Ron Esplin, Maureen Beecher, and Jill Durr. When I said I was interested in co-authoring a biography of Emma Smith, no one laughed, for which I will be eternally grateful. Later, Ron Esplin told me their attitude, all of their attitudes were, well, let's see what they can do. That day, at Ron's suggestion, I also joined the Mormon History Association and bought a membership for Valenswell. My initial shock came when the card catalog at the LDS Archives identified only one small folder of Emma material. It contained a photograph mislabeled Emma Smith, which was actually of her adopted daughter Julia, taken a few months before her own death. With it were a few scraps of information about Emma. I soon discovered treasures, however, hidden in other collections, and of course, one source led to another and another. After each day at the archives, I stopped at Kinko's on my way home, copied everything I had gleaned, and sent it to Val. Sometimes there was as many as two or three large envelopes a week. Each summer, our family drove across the country to visit Jack's father in Ohio, and to vacation at the family cottage in Georgian Bay of Ontario. These trips also enabled me to visit every place that Emma lived. Eventually, the research took me to Stanford University Special Collections, Bancroft Library at UC Berkeley, and twice to the Beinecke Library at Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut. Val and I were able to go together to the Huntington Library in San Marino, and she made a follow-up trip later and was able to meet descendants of Louis Biedemann, Emma's second husband, and secured access to two different collections of his papers, which are now in the LDS Archives. We also traveled together on a trip to the RLDS Archives in Independence, Nauvoo, and Graceland College in Lamoni, Iowa. At our first MHA meeting in St. George the summer before, we had met briefly Paul Edwards, Kay and Alma Blair, Dick Howard, and Bill Russell. They and other RLDS scholars welcomed us warmly, and I also Jan. We also met archivists Madeline Brunson and Patricia Roberts, now Struble, who were incredibly helpful and wonderfully fun. I have to tell one quick story about Madeline. We went over to visit David Hiram's son, Lynn Smith, and he showed us one of Emma's rings, and we both tried it on our finger. And so we went back and excitedly told Madeline that we had had Emma's ring on our finger. And she said, well, I hope it wasn't her wedding ring. We've got four of those in the vault. The RLDS Archives produced the first major shock of our research, the William McClellan letters to Joseph Smith III of January 1861 and July 1872. In those letters, he talked about a number of irregularities in church leadership, including Samuel Smith getting drunk on sacrament wine in the balcony of the Kirtland Temple and throwing up all over the floor, and what McClellan called the Joseph Smith Fanny Alger transaction that Emma witnessed through a crack in the barn door. And there was more. Before we finished, we both felt like we'd been kicked in the stomach. The next morning at breakfast, Val slipped a piece of paper across the table to me. On it, she'd written a quote from Huck Finn. And so there ain't nothing more to write about, and I'm rotten glad of it. Because if I'd have known what a trouble it was to make a book, I wouldn't have tackled it, and I ain't a-going to no more. Through friends and history contacts, word started to travel around Salt Lake that I was working on a biography of Emma Smith, and I began to get invitations to speak about her at firesides, Relief Society meetings, discussion groups, and various other places. I always took questions, and when I didn't know the answer, I focused on finding it the next time I was in the archives. By the way, the most frequent question that I got was, did Emma push Eliza down the stairs? As an aside to this, neither Val and I were accomplished typists. We were terrible. But Val believed that a good typo could be a work of art. One day she called me laughing so hard she could hardly talk. When I asked her what was so funny, she said, "I've been working on Emma, Eliza, and the Stairs issue. I just typed Eliza R. Snot." I might add here that Val and I each hired a typist to do our finished copy. Marilyn Dameron White worked with me in Salt Lake, and Maxine Wood Campbell with Val and Flagstaff. They had identical typewriters, and both were absolutely wonderful to work with. And this was before computers, and they typed a lot of drafts. In the spring of 1979, the Newell family was in England, where Jack had a three-month exchange professorship. MHA held its meetings in Logan that year, and Val went without me. On June 16th, she wrote to me in England. "When I came home from MHA, Chuck told me, 'The kids and I got along just great when you were gone. You didn't need to come home.' He meant it, but he also meant it as a tool and a threat so that I will stay home and be a good wife. I've not understood the depth of his jealousy and frustration with Emma, with the Emma Project, and the success of it is what most threatens him." The letter goes on to assure me that Emma is not the cause of the problem, but only a manifestation of a long time deep-seated problems that they had not solved earlier. Unbeknown to Val, the Flagstaff state president had called Chuck in to talk with him. He told Chuck that Val had no right to delve into church history. Quote, "The church has its own historians," he said, "and if church leaders want history written about Emma Smith or anything else, they will tell those historians to write it." Then he told Chuck, "You must control your wife. She needs to stay home with her family, where she belongs." Chuck did not tell Val of this encounter with the state president until many months later. Caught between his wife and priesthood authority, he chose to tread a middle ground of passive aggression. And I might say here that Chuck is a very lovely man and very kind and dear. And this was a very difficult thing for him and for Val as well. Among other things, he didn't support the project financially, and Val took jobs hanging wallpaper to get money for our joint research account. Not long after that, Val also had a run-in with her bishop, who incidentally was close friends with the state president, and who Val said neither one of them ever read anything beyond the Ensign and Field and String. She was asked to give a talk on Joseph and Emma's children at a fireside with the youth of her ward. In what was probably a lapse of judgment on her part, Val started telling of the possibility of children by Joseph's plural wives. In a letter to me, she wrote, "My bishop was so affronted that he was rude at the fireside, challenged my statements, took the RLDS position that we do not know that Joseph had wives other than Emma, and would not listen when I sought him out privately to explain." Somewhat later, when the gospel doctrine teacher asked Val if she would teach the lesson on Emma and the elect lady revelation, she declined. Sunday morning, as Val was gathering up her papers to leave for church, the phone rang. It was her bishop. "I understand you're going to teach the gospel doctrine lesson this morning on Emma Smith." Val told him no, that she was only going to be a resource. "You will not go in to that class," he said. "As long as I am bishop of this ward, you will not talk about that woman in my church." And he hung up. When Val arrived at the ward house, she saw the bishop in the foyer and tried to talk to him. He turned and walked away, so she followed him into his office and shut the door. He told her he had nothing to say to her, and she replied, "Either you talk to me now, or I will go down the hall and get all four of my kids, take them home, and we will not be back." At that point, they agreed to disagree about Emma if Val would not talk about her in church. I ached for her and what she was going through, and felt guilty because I had none of these experiences. Jack, my ward leaders, and members were fully supportive of what I was doing. Jack and I taught the gospel doctrine class together during most of these years. He supported me in every way, well, except when the phone bill got too big. In one letter to Val, I complained that I had spent nearly 4 hours on this long, detailed letter, something we could have done in a $5 phone call. Instead, I said, I saved $1.25 an hour by writing it down. I believe my time is worth more than $1.25 an hour. Because of where we each lived then, and because of our separate family situations, Val and I had much different experiences during these years. On a weekly basis, I had contact with any number of historians that I could bounce ideas off at any one of the Utah archives. I soon discovered a network of scholars working on their own projects, but interested in sharing relative information with me and others. If I had questions or frustrations, I had only to turn to a friend or at a table nearby or walk down the hall to the historian's office and all those wonderful historians. Val had no one. One day when I called her, I noticed her voice sound strained and far away. I asked if something was wrong. "I'm sick," she whispered. "Sick to my stomach. I've been laying on the floor so I won't throw up." I expressed my concern and asked if she ate something that could have caused it. "No," she said. "I'm just working in the polygamy section of Nauvoo, where Joseph has taken Helen Mar Kimball as a plural wife. Linda, she was only 14. That's how old Maureen is. Maureen is her only daughter." Isolated and alone, Val faced difficult issues with no immediate support. We found that we sometimes drew different conclusions as we wrote. On an almost daily basis, I worked with primary sources, read them carefully when I found them, and again as I filed them. Val placed the copies of my weekly archival gleanings in her files to work with later. Meanwhile, she read the secondary sources and formed opinions and conclusions from them. When she sent me drafts of the manuscript or papers we were writing, I would rewrite them, move sentences and paragraphs around so they were more chronological, and plugging in narratives from primary source materials. Likewise, when I sent drafts to her, she would find that my conclusions sometimes differed from hers, and this was mainly because we were writing from different sources. It became frustrating for both of us. I might say that we got together periodically and just worked together on the manuscript. The first draft, we sat across the table from each other in a condo up at Park City, and I said, "Okay, I'll start here," and Val said, "I'll start here." So when I cut up to her, I jumped ahead, and we just leapfrogged through the manuscript until we had a first draft of it. And then we divided it in sections to rewrite each other's stuff. One of the hardest times in our partnership occurred when we were writing the Nauvoo period. Val had the responsibility for drafting those chapters. When she sent them to me, there were major holes, and I could hardly find Emma. The focus was Joseph and plural marriage. There was nothing on the beginnings of the endowment or Emma's central role in it. Much of what she did in the Relief Society was missing. There was nothing on Joseph III's succession blessing, and that's when we thought we had one, compliments of Mark Hoffman. The narrative had become so strident and out of sequence that I could hardly recognize the story. It dawned on me that Val was transferring her anger at her ecclesiastical leaders and Chuck to Joseph Smith. She began speculating to reach conclusions. Time and time again, I said, "Val, we cannot go beyond our sources. We have to give the relevant information and let the readers draw their own conclusions." It finally hit home, for in the introduction to her wonderful biography of David Smith, From Mission to Madness, she writes, "I avoid imposing interpretations that would preempt the feelings and conclusions of those whose story this is. I keep my own voice muted when their voices can be documented, and I avoid speculation when evidence is inadequate." We both learned a lot from each other. This is not to say, either, that my own writing was not without problems, because it was. Val added her comments and corrections and corrected spelling or grammar. I'm dyslexic, and I often drop or reverse letters in words. Her writing could be eloquent and her reasoning deft. We were able to critique each other's work in a way that our styles eventually flowed together seamlessly. In the end, we joked about what we would say if someone criticized a section of the book. Val was to say, "Oh, Linda wrote that, I didn't." And I would say, "Oh, Val wrote that, I didn't." Toward the end of the manuscript preparation, rumors surfaced that Mark Hoffman had found William McClellan's papers and was negotiating with the church to purchase them. We knew that McClellan had written extensively to Joseph III, as I mentioned earlier, and had visited Emma more than once in Nauvoo. Surely there would be correspondence between him and Emma in his collection, or perhaps journals or diaries that mentioned her. I called Mark and invited him to lunch to talk about the collection. He was eager to talk to me as well, because he had heard about my encounter with a woman in Montana who had been giving sacrament meeting talks, claiming she was a descendant of Emma Smith and that she had Emma's diaries. When I contacted her, she said she had not just the diaries, but a small trunk that had been Emma's, and it contained several diaries, letters, children's drawings, some baby teeth, and a feather. It turned out that she was a pathological liar who made up the story for attention. In our conversation over lunch, I asked Mark questions about the McClellan collection, but he was fairly closed-mouthed about what might be in it. He didn't know yet, probably. I asked him if he would consider selling the papers to the University of Utah or the Huntington Library, any place but the church where they would never see the light of day. He said, "Linda, I'm not in this business for historians. I'm in it for the money." He then asked me about the Montana woman, and I told him the story and how she had come to Salt Lake at my expense with a list of items in the trunk. After talking with Sam Weller and several archivists, she realized that such a collection would be worth over $1 million. I told Mark, I think when she found out how much she could get from them, she thought she could actually forge the papers and sell them. Then I said, do you think someone could actually forge an entire collection? He appeared thoughtful for a few seconds and then shook his head. No, I said, the means for detecting forgeries are so sophisticated nowadays that a person would have to be crazy to try. The finished manuscript tallied 1,000 pages. You can imagine the feeling we experienced when we mailed it to Doubleday. It didn't take long to bring us back to Earth. Our Doubleday editor, Jean Ann Vincent, sent it back and told us to cut it by a third. By now, Val had earned both her master's and doctorate and was teaching history at Northern Arizona University in Flagstaff. Jack and I were the editors of Dialogue, which was a full-time job for me. To have the manuscript back on our laps was a blow. The other disappointment was when Doubleday decided that they would only market the book regionally in several western states. Some have asked where they might be able to read the uncut manuscript. I want to read the good stuff, they would say. Now, why, if you had to trim a manuscript, would you cut out the good stuff? We did make some rules for ourselves. We would not cut in for any information about Emma or any new material, and we would take out things that were common knowledge and didn't relate directly to Emma's story. Then we took each page and said, one-third of this page needs to come out. We trimmed words, sentences, and occasional paragraphs. Later, I realized that in our tightening of the manuscript, we took out a number of well-known stories about Joseph. The new material that we left in tended to be the more controversial things that didn't make it in any of the church literature, the general books about Joseph. But it was there because it added to Emma's story. I believe the process of cutting the manuscript shifted the narrative to a more critical view of Joseph. It was not intentional on either of our parts. It just happened. Finally, on October 4th, 1984, wrong century, Mormon enigma Emma Hill Smith arrived at the bookstores. The response was heady. Bob Breinholt, the Doubleday rep, had set up autograph parties for us at Sam Weller's bookstore and Deseret Book. Kurt Bench ran the rare book department of Deseret Book and was as excited as anyone to see our book come out. One day he watched as an older woman gazed at the dust jacket and then turned to him quizzically. Can you tell me what a Mormon enema is? The book were brisk, and within a month, the first printing was gone, then another. By spring, we were in the third printing. Then one early Sunday morning in May, my phone rang. A friend who served in a bishopric in another ward said, "Linda, something's going on. I don't know what it is yet, but this morning in bishopric meeting, the bishop said he received a call from the state president saying that two girls, Belle and I were over 40, had written a book on Emma Smith, and we were not to encourage the sale of the book by inviting them to speak in our ward." My friend asked if it was Linda Newell they were talking about. "Oh, no," the bishop answered. "Linda spoke in our ward, and she did just fine. This is some woman from Arizona." Before the day was over, I had taken at least a dozen more calls from friends, literally from coast to coast, all with the same news. I telephoned Belle to see if she had heard anything of the kind. She hadn't, but she was as alarmed as I was. That evening, I called my own bishop and asked if he had received a similar call. At first, he hesitated. Then finally, he said that he had. "Why didn't you tell me?" I asked. "Because the state president told me not to tell anybody." I hung up and dialed Gene Hansen, my stake president. He agreed to see Jack and me the next morning at 7 o'clock. President Hansen was wonderful. The first thing he said when we sat down in his office was, "You are my parishioner, Linda, and I will see you through this no matter what or how long it takes." And he did. He said the area president had called him and told him to relay the message to all bishops in the state, and that they were not to invite Val or me to speak in any of their meetings. He did not know who authorized the calls, but assumed it came from the Quorum of the 12. I wanted to know if I'd been disfellowshipped or if I'd been tried for my membership. Did it mean I could not teach a class, give a prayer, or answer a question in class? Could the whole thing be a mistake? He didn't know, but he said he would find out. I insisted that I should be able to speak to whoever instigated it. He said he didn't think that would be possible. At that point, Jack interceded. "You are a lawyer. You know that Linda has a right to face her accusers." What President Hansen found out and reported to me in a subsequent meeting was that we were not to speak in any church meeting, in any church building, on anything having to do with church history. "So I can talk on any subject that I don't know anything about," I said. He laughed and said, "Yes, it looks that way." The calls to state presidents and bishops had gone out in three states, Utah, Idaho, and Arizona. I would not be able to talk with anyone higher than he. It took about 3 weeks before it leaked to the press. John Dart from the Los Angeles Times was the first to call me. I tried to talk him out of doing the story because I was still hoping to get an appointment with someone in the Quorum of the 12, and I knew that as soon as the story came out in the press, there would be no chance of getting the decision turned around. But it was the catalyst for finally getting me an appointment with Dallin Oaks and Neil Maxwell. I invited Jack and President Hansen to go with me. As I was getting ready to leave the dialogue office for the appointment, my phone rang. It was a friend in the church public relations department. He said, "Linda, I think that you should know that you will not be talking to anyone who has read the book. In fact, as far as we can tell, no one in the Quorum of the 12 has read it." The meeting was cordial and pleasant. The two apostles listened carefully to my concerns, but clearly they could not change anything. When I asked if either of them had read the book, Elder Oaks replied that they couldn't read everything. But if someone had complained about a paragraph, he read the whole chapter. He said he had read all the middle chapters. "Then you've read it out of context," I said. "You don't know that we tried to prepare the reader in the earlier chapters for more difficult sections of the book. And you don't know how we dealt with Emma in the post-martyrdom era." Then I asked, "What exactly was the problem with the book?" And he replied, "It's a non-traditional view of Joseph Smith." I pointed out that it was not Joseph Smith's biography this time. It was Emma's. And we were women telling the story of a woman. At that time, that was non-traditional. Afterwards, Jack helped me put together a statement for John Dart. The story appeared in the front page of the religion section of the Los Angeles Times. It was over a half a page long. The Associated Press picked it up, and it went to newspapers all over the states. My phone rang constantly. Friends sent clippings from their newspapers from the Sacramento Bee to the Boston Globe and even a magazine in Paris. Sales of the book tripled. Meanwhile, Balagan, isolated in Flagstaff, did not hear anything from her stake president or bishop or any church authority. It took until the next May to finally get it turned around. Jean Hansen once again interceded in my behalf. I was going to do a program on KSL about MHA. The afternoon before I went on the program, Jean Hansen called and said, "I have good news. You're no longer under any restrictions." I thanked him and immediately called Val. I also called Louise Daines to tell her the news. The next day on the program, the entire KSL Morning News staff greeted me with congratulations and good wishes. Sure enough, the second question I got was about the ban, and it came, unbeknown to me, from a reporter from the Associated Press, who Louise, unbeknown to me again, had called. I simply answered there had been a problem, but I had received word that Val and I were no longer under any restrictions. Interestingly, when the story was printed across the country, the Salt Lake Tribune ran it, but Deseret News did not, although they had printed a story when the ban was initiated. And it wasn't until several years later that I discovered that that we had already also been blacklisted and that we would not be able to be quoted or cited in any church publications with Deseret Book, Bookcraft, or anything like that. It's been 25 years since the publication of Mormon Enigma. Val's marriage did not survive. None of her children are active in the church. Only my son is active in our family. Val's death 3 years ago was a blow to all of us who loved her. She left a huge hole in Mormon history circles. Sales of our book has been steady. University of Illinois Press published a second revised edition in 1994, which enabled us to make a number of corrections, mainly associated with documents that were forged by Mark Hoffman. Sales hold steady at just under 1,000 copies a year. Hopefully, it will remain a mainstay in Mormon history in the foreseeable future. Thank you very much.